Yeah, so basically, before they just had tungsten water, and I think they also had a little bit perhaps of potassium or some electrolyte, and then they blasted it for 400 seconds or 4,000 seconds, and they looked at it and they had found the formation of gold.
Welcome, everyone, for another podcast with yours truly, David Morgan of themorganreport.com. I have Ken Schwartz with me today. Some of you will know him, some may not. I'm going to have him introduce himself. I've known of him because I've listened to some of his features, one in particular that is the reason I'm asking for the interview. So, Ken, first of all, thank you for your time. And secondly, a bit of a shout out to Jean-Claude because he comes up with some really interesting stuff that covers the gamut. Much more than myself, who I specialize pretty much on the finance and precious metals and resource stocks. But Ken, welcome aboard. Give us some background, and then I'm going to really drill down on this gold situation that we've talked about in the past. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, glad to be on. And a little bit, I guess I'm a biogeochemist. I got a degree out of the University of Colorado, master's. And so I'm not piled higher and deeper. And a little bit about the story. It's one of the things I kind of came across. I call it metal oxygen fusion. And it was actually discovered back in the late 1950s, even before I was born. And it was two Japanese researchers, Osawa and Kushi. They discovered it, and I had read about it decades before. And then I was in the right time with the right people in the right place, and we confirmed Osawa and Kushi's discoveries. And that's basically the short story of kind of how it went it came across.
Well, you sent me the papers on this. I read them and I got a bit of a fairly strong physics background and I understood maybe 80% of it after reading them twice. But these are peer-reviewed papers. I mean, we're not making this stuff up. My question is kind of verify that for me and let's move on from there. So how many people have looked at this and know it's true?
Well, we've got there's one of them. Well, for people listening, what you could go to is you could just go into your search engine and type in MOXY Fusion Research Gate, and that'll take you to a link where you can get the paper yourself, and then you could like bring it up, and then as I talk about it or bring up diagrams that you would be able to see what I'm talking about. Yeah, it's what happened is Osawa and Kushi. They're Japanese researchers, as you might imagine, and they sort of had a yin yang version of the element charts, right? The yin was on one side, like the alkali metals and alkali, and then on the other side were the halides, and that was kind of the yang. And so, they had the idea by combining the two, you could produce new elements. We in the West we call that electronegativity, but so they basically worked, and their defining study, I guess, was what they basically did is they rebuilt a sodium street lamp bulb. It's kind of a simple experiment, and but they made it out of ceramic because it's going to get pretty hot and pressure in there, and it had a little quartz window in it. And what they did is they put in, it's like a sodium street lamp, so they put in sodium, but they put in an equal amount of oxygen, and they pressurized it with argon, the moderator, which is really important. It's the argon gas. And then they turned it on, and as you could imagine, they could see through the little quartz window the kind of that orange yellow glow of a sodium street lamp. But over several hours, that glow turned to a purple color. And that purple color is the appearance of potassium. And if you were to fuse oxygen with sodium, you would make potassium. Now, what we did for ours, because potassium hydroxides, if you're working with that, is kind of toxic. And in the same family as potassium, we were also looking for an energy production, for producing energy, basically making heat, boiling water. And so what we chose is we chose to use deuterium, which is in, which is a hydrogen isotope. It's in the same family as sodium and lithium and potassium and all those. And we also, of course, would use oxygen with it. So we basically used heavy water in our reactor, and we pressurized it with just atmospheric pressure of oxygen, and we got it to work. And if you were to look at basically what it is, see, when you use MOXIe fusion, this whole process, metal oxygen fusion, the Coulomb barrier, which is the barrier that prevents elements from fusing, is greatly decreased by millions of times. And so it allows fusion to happen much easier. And in our fusion, we basically used we used digital X-ray plates. Well, we also had X-ray film, and we also had a multi-band spectral analyzer. But, you know, here's an example of it. If you go to the MOXIe paper, that'd be page 16. When we didn't have, you see the white thing. And when we turned it on, and we also used about 5,000 electron volts. That's the level, which is way below the production of X-rays. But when we had everything together and it was running, you would get it would blacken that X-ray plate within just about a minute, solid. And that's kind of how. So we were doing that. But there's another group that we did the experimentation back in 2011, and then I think we put our research paper up, or in one form or another, we've had the research paper up since 2014 on ResearchGate. And by the way, you know, one of the things we're also battling for the U.S. for a patent on it, you know, they've been bouncing around. And one of their complaints, of course, was not enough third-party evidence. And of course, well, what happened was, unbeknownst to us, some people had read our paper and they redid our experiment, except they didn't use a multi-spectral analyzer like we had. Or X-ray plates. X-ray plates were mostly for the safety. They actually, I guess they probably had a little bit of problem. So they used what is a glass bead detector. And a glass bead detector detects elements. So it could detect, like, for in our case, we were taking deuterium and oxygen 16. You'd fuse it together. It would make fluoride 18. And then the fluoride 18 would electron capture and decay into oxygen 18. And what they did is they basically did the same experiment. And their experiment, if you could probably go to ResearchGate and get it too. And I'll just say it, I'll put it up there too. Experiments demonstrating the creation of elements via pulsed electric field in water and deuterated water applications to the production of fluoride. I'll put that up there for a second if people can type that down. And they actually confirmed it. So when the reactor wasn't running, they didn't see any fluoride, but they turned it on and then they'd see the production of fluoride. So for basic, you know, if people were to kind of look at this, let's see if that's getting in there. Is that decent to see?
Yeah, no, very clear.
Yeah, so that's the top one is what Osawa and Kushi did. They just used sodium and oxygen and they made potassium. And it was really straight across in all the atomic levels batch with oxygen and deuterium. It made fluoride, but it's really fluoride 18 is an unstable metal, unstable element, and so it rapidly decays into oxygen 18. And another side product, and we had, like, when we ran the multi-band spectral analyzers, there was a bunch of spikes, and the bottom one, there's a lot of oxygen 18 in heavy water, just by the nature of the way it's made, and that was be making neon 20. Of course, there was a when it hit the iron electrode, it was doing a whole bunch of other fusion reactions. But that was a minor thing. So those were that's basically showed that it was making it. But and I've actually never published the paper on the full experimentation. That's we're waiting for that someday. Maybe a nice journal like Nature will want it or something. But what I did is I put out the paper that you have here. And I basically, it sort of comes over the whole concept of metal oxygen fusion. And as we know, the one you were talking about was the interested in, which obviously for the people on the show was gold. And so, and we might as well go for that one there. So what they did there is, here we go. And this is on page 30. So let's go there and I'll just kind of bring it up. Yeah, obviously, you're probably kind of hard to see on the screen. So that's why if you go to MOXIe Fusion ResearchGate, you can just get it up. And what these guys, there was two, this is back half, this happened, you know, I went through the literature. I read voraciously. So I found these, this, and this was done in 2004 with two people, Cirilio and Yorgi. And so what they basically did is they had more like an electrolytic cell, and they had two electrodes, and they just blasted it with high amounts of electricity, and then out of the metal oxide, the tungsten metal oxide, which forms on probably the cathode, maybe even the anode too, They did a spectral analysis, and this is kind of the results for people there. And for people that don't know, that AU stands for gold, and the TH stands for, the TM stands for thulium, but I'll get onto that. And so, yeah, so basically, you know, before they probably just, they just had tungsten, water, and I think they also had a little bit perhaps of potassium or some electrolyte, and then they blasted it for 400 seconds or 4,000 seconds, and they looked at it, and they had found the formation of gold, but not just gold. They found the formation of also rhenium, which is, it's like there's gold, then there's platinum, then there's rhenium. So there's a, that's another platinum group metal. And so they had done that. There's about four isotopes of tungsten. So each isotope would, when you take a tungsten fuses with oxygen, then, and there's four different isotopes. Isotopes, by the way, are, the element has the same number of protons, but the isotopes have different numbers of neutrons. They're the neutral particle. And so when you do a metal oxygen fusion, depending on the isotope, you get a different result. So they were getting gold, rhenium. What was really also really interesting in this is that they're also getting thulium, which is a rare earth metal, and it's lower in atomic weight than tungsten. But what's also present in the spectral analysis is beryllium. And beryllium is only produced by fission. So in some cases, one of the isotopes was unstable, and the whatever the daughter product of tungsten oxygen was, that that was unstable in the deuterium. And so it, instead of building up to a bigger one, such as gold or rhenium, it actually disintegrated the daughter molecule and produced thulium, which is a rare earth element and valuable in and of itself. Rhenium is also valuable, by the way, and but it also proves that beryllium, and that beryllium proves that fission, that fission had also occurred. So it's kind of like a fusion fission process, which is really important because there's another at the very end of the paper. There's another another experiment by a Dr. Bass, the late Dr. Bass, and he had he basically was taking was turning a tenth of a gram of thorium into isotopes of copper and tin, kind of unique isotopes of copper and tin, and for about 300 watts of power, which is really low to transmute. And as you go down in the, we found in our experimentation, you go down in the atomic chart, each level you get lower, you it's about 10 times or more easier to produce fusion. Or in this case, fusion and fission, because that's what Dr. Bass was doing. Unfortunately for Dr. Bass, he didn't do his atomics right, and probably he was being X-rayed, and it also would produce a short-lived radioactive gas. I think it would be probably, I think, xenon in his case. And that's probably the reason why he's the late Dr. Bass.
So we talked earlier about this being actually commercially viable, correct? So with you know, the elements that we start with, tungsten being very, very close on the periodic chart to gold, and then using this energy, you know, it's an energy equation, energy in, energy out. And if you get an element of gold sitting there, you're performing modern day alchemy. Am I correct?
Yes, and that's exactly right. And from the Dr. Bass, that's why I brought him up. I mean, that's a tenth of a gram is... that's 300 watts. Okay, let's go up to a gram. 1 gram, that's 3,000 watts, 3,000 or 3 kilowatts. And kilowatts are what, 20 cents? So that's 60 cents in energy to convert a gram of thorium into these other elements. So that's, you know, that's very inexpensive. And so, yeah, it technically the input price on inputs for that with the, with, you just need tungsten oxide. You don't need the, you don't need the pure metal. And also you have the argon gas moderator, and which drives the fusion reaction by a thousandfold, and so you'd be, your inputs would be under $100 in energy and the physical input. Obviously the machines themselves will cost a bit of money, but you know they're like a fixed cost, not the variable cost. But your variable input cost would be under $100. For the platinum group metals, there's a zirconium oxide. You can buy it from China, powderized, for $50.50 a pound, and it's usually 4% contaminated with hafnium, which is in the same family as zirconium. They kind of come together, and they're little zircons. I don't know if people zircons. You probably heard from the zircon rings, but they're also made in granite mountains, little zircons, and they're harder, almost as hard as diamonds. There's like beach sand that's like 40% zircons, you know, ground up, and so that's kind of where they refine it from. And so that's 50 cents a pound. The argon doesn't cost much. The electricity doesn't come much. So you can actually produce the platinum group metals. And somebody did Hudson did that. That's another story, which would take another hour or two, that actually appears to have produced that. And let us say there's in Asia, there's several Asian countries that are doing research on this right now. And a whole bunch of private individuals, some who have contacted me, some who haven't. And so this is actually happening right as we speak. So this isn't theoretical. It's actually, you could do this in your garage if we really wanted to. Of course, be aware that there's going to be you're going to be producing a lot of X-rays. In fact, that's probably the other interesting story I should bring up.
Go ahead.
Yeah, remember the Fleischmann and Pons on that cold fusion stuff in 1989?
Yeah, because I'm really big on the PGMs. I write about it in my private work, and that was fascinating to me because the big picture for me is energy. I mean, if we could get cheap energy for everybody, we're going to get rid of a lot of the world's problems. But back to you.
Well, that's why I actually, went for the deuterium and by the way, when we were doing like our third party testing down at TSA Systems, it's up the road from us, and they make actually all the detectors for the TSA for so that you don't have radiological stuff coming in airplanes or trains or boats or whatever. And but on the weekends when nobody was working there, we used to go down there with one of the scientists there, and we'd get to access their multi-band spectral analyzer, which was had like 50 channels, right? It was a beautiful thing. But because we couldn't certainly afford it at that time. So, but what Fleischmann's and Pons were, they basically had these, they had platinum or palladium electrodes, and they'd put them in there, and they'd have deuterium, heavy water, and they'd turn them on, and they'd get excesses of heat, and they'd find a little bit of helium, right? Helium-4. And there was, and it actually was reproduced by MIT, even though MIT covered it up. So there was excess heat out of that. And by the way, when we were doing it in ours with the deuterium and the oxygen, boy, we had a little chamber. We had to like pack it in ice, because if we ran that thing for more than a minute, it would overheat so much that that the air would get too thin, and the spark would break down. So that's why we went with the one we did. For those guys, what they were doing, unfortunately for them, what they were doing is they're actually doing moxie fusion. It wasn't deuterium. Deuterium, it was platinum and palladium. Can you see that pretty good?
Yep.
Yeah, that's what they were doing. Either you use the platinum or palladium. And you notice when you make, when you take a platinum and you fuse it with oxygen, you make radon. And when you take palladium and you fix it with oxygen, you make radioactive xenon, which is an alpha emitter, the one is an alpha emitter. So this is they took one of those Fleischmann-Pons cells, and there's a P39, it's the same, when you want to test for radon in your basement, you get that little box, when you open it up and the air gets in there, well, in that box, a little P39, it's a little tiny piece of like a resin plastic, and what happens is if there's an alpha particle, a radon breaks down, releases alpha particle nearby, it'll punch into that little piece of plastic. Then you take that tiny chip of plastic and they soak it in hot sodium hydroxide, which is very caustic. And wherever those alpha particles hit, it causes a weakness, and they'll etch out little pits. So one guy took and put a bunch of those little chips on top of one of those Fleischmann-Pons electrolytic cells where we were actually getting some excess heat and stuff. And see, this is the before, and you see there's like maybe a couple little pits in there. And then the after effects. And you may notice that thing is just massively pitted. So unfortunately for Fleischmann, that's an electrolytic cell. So that was venting directly into the air of the laboratory. So imagine something hundreds of times worse with radon concentration than your worst radon basement. And see, in 89, when it came out in 90, you know, the at first there was, you know, it was amazing and people were getting results, but it was threatening the hot fusion guys, right? With ITER and all those projects, billions of dollars was on the line. If you could do it on your tabletop, basically, then, you know, their hot fusion is in trouble. So they just came down on those two guys really bad and just made their lives hell. And Pons, he was from France. So he just blew, he just went back to France to eat baguettes and drink wine and didn't do any more research on it because he was still respected there. Of course, Fleischmann being American, he had nowhere to go. So he stayed there and kept doing these experimentations and breathing radon air and probably getting x-rayed excessively. And that's why he's the late Dr. Fleischmann. So if you're going to do boxy fusion, you need to make sure you know what you're doing, because it can be dangerous. The x-rays and potentially radioactive gases.
Well, let's circle back to the gold thing. Tell me, how commercially viable is this? If we wanted to really take it on?
Well, it's extremely commercially viable. Osawa and Kushi, if you go to my paper and you go back and look at the references, and you can go and get the references, right, and read the papers that are the references. And Osawa and Kushi will almost be able to make commercially viable levels of potassium from just taking salt, you know, sodium and oxygen, putting them in the reactor. You know, you can almost make pure, you make highly pure potassium at a commercial level. That's what they were claiming. Of course, that Japan was under occupation and that threatened it. So yeah, it's extremely, and I can tell you right now, there are some people out there doing this, and it's probably, production's probably still under a kilogram of a week, but that's only temporary. And, you know, someday it'll be 100 kilograms a week and then 1,000 kilograms a week. And then when it gets to be, you know, 10 metric tons, that's really going to make an effect on the gold price. And if they were like, let's say, a hobby enthusiast, it would be pretty easy to do. You can basically do kind of the same thing that Osawa and Kushi did, a little modifications. Basically, you know, if you were going to do this, you got to have a up on the top here. There we go. On the top there, basically, you could use a sodium street lamp power supply, and you just put a bridge diode in front of it, and that'll turn it into a DC pulse sodium street lamp power supply. And then down below, really all you need is a pressurized cell. You got like a graphite crucible full of whatever metal oxygen you want. You got the anode underneath. You got the cathode above it, and you pressurize it, of course, with argon. And you just run a big electrical pulses through that, which you'll be producing. And that's really all you need to, if you want to make gold in your basement. Technically, if we look on paper, we're not doing that at the moment. Anyway, it would be viable. I don't know what the cost of making the machine and the little crucibles. You'd probably just use them, throwaway crucibles. You make them, you'd use them, and then you'd put another one in there, let it cool down. And because there may be a little bit of radioactive whatever in there. And so getting so don't forget, you know, you need x-ray dosimeters and maybe x-ray plates or film to make sure that you see if it's working. And you have to have protection, everything. But yeah, it's doable and it's commercially viable. And some people are doing it. We know there's several governments in Asia and somewhere and elsewhere. And we know there's a lot more private organizations that are doing it. Some are companies, some are individuals. Some of them contact us, some of them don't. It's like, we had no idea about, you know, the Scotia Group, by the way, did this one, the one that that imitated our experiment. And they actually filed a patent. I don't know if they followed up on it for the production of fluoride 18 for oncology. They attach it to sugars, and then because sugar likes cancers, so you'd drink that, and then the fluoride 18 would build up in the cancer, and then you'd go to the positron decay imaging thing, and you could tell whether you had cancers or where they were.
What I found interesting with your interview with Jean-Claude was, I think he brought you over to silver, and it was, you know, very economically viable on gold, but yet silver was not. Can you explain that?
Yeah, because every time you go up on the ladder, it's about 10 times more harder to do for the more energy and stuff that you're going to needing. And so of all the precious metals, silver would be the hardest to synthesize. So like platinum and it's just in the corner there. It would be the hardest to synthesize of all the metals. So that would be, and of course, you know, this is really small right now, and it's an experimental stage, and people are doing the research, but it's you know, in the future though, I think the price of many precious metals, if not all metals, because you can also make a lot of the rare earth metals, which is important because, you know, that's another missing thing. Like you could use moxie, you could take certain isotopes of iron or nickel, and with oxygen, moxie, because the, you know, the Chinese have cut America off from geranium and gadolinium. Well, you can just take the certain nickel isotopes and iron isotopes and moxie them and make all the gadolinium and geranium you want, right? Doesn't matter. So a lot of mining that exists now is going to go away because you can get basic, very common elements, and then with moxie fusion, you can fuse them up into more complex and more valuable elements. And you know, I'm not the creator of it, obviously. I didn't. This was Osawa and Kushi did that. And there's a whole bunch of other guys like Yorye and Carrillo that did the gold one, right? They did that, but nobody really understood the mechanism except Osawa and Kushi back in the day. That it's because everyone thinks that, you know, it has to be some isotopes of hydrogen to fuse, right? Tritium and deuterium, or two deuteriums, or whatever, like it's in the sun, and that's the only sort of fusion that's happening. But no, there's this metal oxygen fusion, and it's millions of times easier than what's going on in the core of the sun. And part of that is what we're doing when we're doing our electrical discharge. We're making solitons, and solitons are like, imagine an electron smoke ring or smoke ring of electrons. And that's what we're doing. We're making it. And, you know, the electric, and when it impacts or goes through our medium and hits the anode and then gets squeezed, you have like on the outside, you have all these electrons spinning around. But on the inside, you have these, I guess, fully ionized negatively baryon cores of whatever material. Argon's really important because it kind of makes it's a moderator that drives the process. It's probably actually any noble gases, and so different noble gases work better with different fusion systems, moxie fusion systems. But argon's cheap and available, right? You can go down to the gas store and buy it by, you know, the giant gas. You can't hardly get hold of neon because they use neon to clean silicon chips. And Ukraine used to be one of the main producers of that. And now neon is so expensive. It's just ridiculous. And so that's basically what you do.
Well, coming back to rare earth elements, because I was one of the first to report on them, and it wasn't really me, it's a friend of mine that actually specialized in REEs. It's a long story, I won't bore you. But Matt Watson, who does great research across the board in all the metals, said on one of his recent interviews, he does like a green energy report, a green metals report for Kitco. I think it's once a week. Very bright guy, we're friends, don't know him real well. Said, you know, there's lots of REEs. It's just that the processing is so toxic. That's why, you know, one of the main and only rare earth element mines left in the U.S. exports everything to China to have it refined and brought back. And when I said that on one of the last TV shows I've ever been on, this is years ago, the woman blew her mind. She couldn't believe it, but that was the truth. So going with this method, of course, you have to have the, I guess, a gas mask type of thing and protection from radiation. But nonetheless, I mean, this is really kind of a breakthrough in REEs where we wouldn't really have to be dependent on China. Am I right?
Yeah, and that's one of the problems with rare earth elements is they have the same outer valence electron, right? So you can't separate them chemically. You have to actually use these diffusion columns. It's a very... I mean, they're just, they'd fill, you know, to do it, it's just huge. It just takes forever, costs so much money to separate them because they can't really be, they have these diffusion columns you run, you have them in a solvent, you run it through, and just slight molecular weights. I mean, it's like separating 235 from 238 in uranium. But one of the interesting thing is here is it appears in some of these, like the one that Yorye and Carrillo did, is that it just produced one rare earth element. Right. So you don't have to go and separate it from the other 15, because they're always all found the same together, right? And then you got to separate them out. Well, if you have a MOXIe process that only produces one rare earth element, then you don't have that huge refining cost. You can just get that thing right out right away. And, you know, I'm just going from other people's research. Obviously, I don't have the budget to do all of this other stuff, but there's an example there where they make thulium, which is a rare earth element. And if that was the only rare earth element produced through that process, then bam, you could get that. And obviously the research there, probably all the different ones. Neodymium, though, by the way, isn't really a rare. It's actually, you can get neodymium, you know, black sand, which is for gold miners, know that black sand. About 1% of that black sand is actually neodymium. And so we have infinite, and what you do is just get the black sand, they run it through a magnetic separator, you know, the more the black, the rest, the other stuff is basically iron oxide, Fe3O4, and it's magnetic, so you can pull it out and leave the neodymium behind. So I'm surprised they don't do neodymium refining from black sands. It's just a mining technique that I just don't understand why it isn't being done, because there's almost infinite amounts of black sand. And if 1% of black sand is neodymium oxide, then why aren't they doing it? Anyway,
well, I think we've covered everything I want to cover. Is there anything you'd like to add on? And then I want to close out at your call on, you know, what you do for a living, or at least partly what you do for a living with C60.
Well, then I'll give you the C60 part. Yeah. One of the things is before Gary Rodriguez and I and Ty Simpson, and we were doing the research, you know, there's a lot of late professors and dead doctors associated with this. Ken Shoulders, you know, Dr. Bass, Fleischman, you know, all these guys, they'd kick the bucket. So, and I figured it was because of the Lord Kohlenberry and the production of x-rays, but you never know. It's research, right? And so I went out looking for something to protect against the radiation. I came across this stuff called carbon-60, C60 for short. And basically, I read this a couple articles where they gave one set of rats get C60, the other set doesn't. They hit them with a multiple fatal dose of radiation. This pretty much all the C60 rats live, or of course the control group dies. So when I learned about that, I went out and got a couple sources of C60, and we were taking it during the experimentation, and we're all alive, by the way. So I guess it must have worked for that. But what happened to me is I kept taking it afterwards, because even after experimentation was over, because, you know, it gave me a little bit more energy, better mental focus. And, you know, the afternoon blahs you get after you eat like a lunch, you know, you want to go take a nap, that went way down. And so, but what really kind of caught my attention is about 7 months after I started taking C60, I went in for my annual optometrist, eye doctor update, right? And I had Drews, or what's called dry macular degeneration, and it had been progressing for years, and I'd been taking the lanthins and zeanthins and all those things you need, you know, you're supposed to, but, you know, it was just still slowly progressing. I went in and my Drews, or dry macular degeneration, had completely disappeared.
Wow.
Which was, you know, like a miracle. My optometrist, you know, he's a really old guy, he had never seen that happen in his many decades of practice. And then in the meantime, my electrical engineer, Gary Rodriguez, he had developed severe wet macular degeneration, primarily because he had type 2 diabetes. That's kind of goes, they go together. And so what I did for him is I made a C60 preparation in MCT oil. And I don't know if people know, MCT stands for medium chain triglycerides. And they're turned by your liver into ketones. And then your cells, especially your brain cells, can use those as flex fuel. So if you can't burn glucose, you could certainly burn the ketones. So that's kind of why I made it in him. And he took a tablespoon a day for a little bit over a year, and his severe wet macular degeneration completely disappeared, and his type 2 diabetes went subclinical. And that's kind of what started it. So I learned ways of making C60 preparations. And like one I made for myself, because I, you know, have a sensitive digestive system. So if I took like an ounce of olive oil, I might have to go visit the bathroom. So what I did is I put it in avocado oil, which is much easier to digest it. And during that, I was like sending out bottles to various internet influencers that I liked. And one of them was Cliff High. And then one
Okay.
day, Cliff High got on Sarah Westall's show and mentioned that that this C-60 had saved his life. And sales just, because it was, I was just a little, he went through the roof. I was just like a little C-60 milkman. I just had various
Yeah.
alternative healthcare things. So I was using it for friends and family. And then I went with my alternative healthcare doctors, and they had good results. They were doing it with their patients, and it was not that big. It was like a side gig thing. And then that blew up, and that eventually it started C60 Purple Power, but then eventually I got partners, and now it's C60 Power. And our website is shopc60.com, and you can go there. Oh, by the way, we set you up a code. So if you're going to go there, type in Morgan for the coupon code, and you will get 10% off on an order, and
Oh, thank you.
you'll get your 10% too. So yeah,
Okay.
just something that's we do there that. So that's kind of that's kind of they came out of Moxie Fusion, and it's kind of it pays the bills and everything, and it's been fun because I get love letters, right? People send us
Sure.
things on how. Because we have had my macular degeneration's gone, Gary's is gone, but we've like dozens of customers have come in. And by the way, I'm not a medical doctor. I can get net met and cannot give medical advice. And these products have not been examined by the FDA and are not, are not meant to treat, cure, prevent any disease. Right?
Right.
Individual results may vary. Right? I'll just say those little disclaimers there. But I could just tell you get all these miraculous stories because what C60 basically is, it's a SOD catalase mimic. And so if there's basically four big antioxidants that, especially in your mitochondria, but in your cells in general, are really important. And one is CoQ10, right?
Right.
And you should be, if you're especially if you've got gray hair, you should be supplementing with CoQ10. Another is glutathione. And now they have good liposomal glutathions that are or sublingual that'll go in and help. And you should be supplementing for that. But there was nothing for SOD and catalase because there's really no mechanism to get SOD inside of the cells because it's an endogenously produced, it's produced in the cells to, protect the mitochondria from superoxide, which is the most damaging oxidative radical in the body. And then SOD and catalase work together to get rid of superoxide. Well, C60 gets rid of superoxide all by itself. Superoxide is just an oxygen with an extra electron. And oxidative damage in your body is your body rusting, right? So an oxygen with an extra electron, that's the most rusting thing that could rust, right? The possible. So C60 just steals the electron off and it just goes back to a regular oxygen, goes back in the Krebs cycle. And then C60 pulls a positive hydrogen ion out of the environment, uses it to neutralize that electron, and then just resets itself. So it could reset itself again and again and again, hundreds of times a second, whatever it takes. And that's why it's so effective. And it spends somewhere between 4 to 10 days in the body, and then it just kind of washes out because it only interacts with two things, superoxide and the hydroxyl ion, which are the two most damaging oxidative radicals in the body. And they're the and there's they aren't used as signaling molecules for the body because there's things like nitrogen oxide, right? And that's the vasodilator, for guys, especially guys, that's really important.
Right.
And there's hydrogen peroxide, and there's a bunch of others that are based around sulfur and iron and zinc, and they tend to be lower energy. And C60 doesn't interfere with any of the body's signaling molecules. And for like safety thing, they did it, because obviously, the macular degeneration went away. They had one where, they injected it into the rabbits, the knees of rabbits, and of course, as it causes all the inflammation, not only cause the inflammation, but the cause the promoted the growth of cartilage. It also stimulates stem cell production. In fact, the first human thing, they put C60 in a cream and applied it facially and found that it reduces lines and wrinkles in Japanese women. And then they had another where they rubbed it on, the scalp, and it helped regrow hair. People that take C60 know your hair and nails grow much more. Sorry, guys, it will not stop male pattern baldness. Slows it down, but it won't stop it. That's a genetic thing. And so C60 doesn't work at that genetic level. And so, and so that all those different things. So anyway, get back to the story. They gave, usually in health beneficial dose, you'd be taking it's like 0.1 milligrams to 0.2 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. And so what they did is they said, at what level? Because they're having, I mean, if you go look at the literature, there's a website called whatisc60.org. And that's like a 501c3 that we support along with other C60 companies. And so you can go there and get the human studies, the animal studies. Like, for instance, particles of C60 have no beneficial, they have to be dissolved, 100% dissolved to have any health benefits.
That's
Particles
why
are
they have
actually,
them in the oil, right?
yeah, exactly. It's non-polar, so it has to be dissolved in oil. It can't dissolve in water. And if anybody tells you they got water-soluble C60, there is a type, a polyhydroxynated, but nobody's selling that in the consumer market. The other people that are actually selling you are just selling you particles of C60 suspended in water. Won't do you any good. And I could get out of that. But anyway, they gave rats 1 gram per kilogram of body weight. It's like 10, 5 to 10,000 times, which is a health beneficial dose. And if you did that with like vitamin E or vitamin D, you would have killed the rats. But with C60, it had no negative effects
Oh.
because the superoxide ion and the hydroxyl ion are not used by the body as signaling molecules. So it didn't, and it's also the only antioxidant which increases athletic performance.
Well,
And
isn't the theory that, or maybe it's not a theory, that the more free radicals you have in your system, the more you age, and that when you're able
oh,
to,
yes. Yeah, and as
interesting.
you reduce those, yeah, especially and that's what you do. Like CoQ10 does a job on some free radicals, glutathione does a job on some free radicals, but there was nothing for SOD and catalase. So it just kind of fills that slot. We have a lot of doctors that use C60 and have their patients use C60 because it kind of fills a very specific slot. But we've had guys that have gone from mid-pack to champions in their field using C60. So they put it, they usually, what they do is they also use it in the MCT because they love the MCT because you get the boost from the medium chain triglycerides. And then the C60 reduces the oxidative. So you can run longer, lift more. It just lowers it, but lowers your rate at which you'll get lactic acid because the Krebs cycle is working better. And so they've gone from mid-pack to champions in their field. So I will not name any names, but C60 is not banned by any athletic organization. So it's great. There's some horses out in Ireland that are also benefiting from C60.
Well, I wanted to visit a little more. I'm certainly not at your level, but I remember when medium chain triglycerides came out in, let's say, the elite athlete world. And I remember they call it the fatless fat, and what it did, and basically helps you to burn fat, right?
Yes.
Because as you said, you go into ketosis. So is there any research on C60 with MCT that you increase the metabolism?
Not really. Not on that. The
Okay.
most of it's been with olive oil, and because that's easy characteristic. But I can tell you from personal experience and customers' experience. Well, a lot of people do that. We have we have some in like our flavored, and or you could just do this. And a lot of people use it in their keto coffee. Because you
Okay.
can do, because I for instance, I'm just my, I used to have a little bit of excess weight, and nothing had ever worked for me until I discovered intermittent fasting. And intermittent fasting, I mean, if you, yeah, you should explore it. If you have a little extra weight, explore intermittent fasting out there because it does amazing things. But MCT oil, like if you take it in the morning with your coffee, it keeps you in ketosis, so it's not like you're breaking your fast. So we have a lot of people do that. They put the coffee, especially our flavored one. We have a cinnamon flavor. People like that. They'll put it in their coffee in the morning. And so you're still in ketosis. You can't put cream in your coffee, by the way. It's just coffee and the MCT.
Okay.
And then you can get a little boost. And a lot of people use it in the afternoons because the MCT will give you a little boost and the C60 kind of. Oh, and I do have to do the one counterindication. If you're on blood thinners, you probably don't want to, you consult with your doctor before taking C60, because one of the things, because C60 restarts mitochondria in the cells, and your adrenal glands, they make when you take C60, your adrenal glands are going to restart. They're going to produce a lot more of whatever it is. Adrenals produce the androgens, which is it gets turned into testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. By the way, another side effect of C60 is a significant increase in libido in both men and women. Because of those increased androgens. But another thing that the adrenals make is mineral corticoids. And they're really key in regulating, quote, blood thickness, even though that's not really a medical term. And so if you take C60, it'll restart your mineral corticoid production. And then if your blood will go back to where it should be. And if you're on a blood thinner now, your blood's too thin. So you need to consult with your doctor and get more testing. And it's not going to happen overnight, but like for instance, we have tests on the like we had a guy in his 70s or old. He'd gone into to his doctor. His testosterone was 350, so the doctor gave him some creams, and he'd been going around for a year or two at about low 700s. He took C60 a month or two later. He went in to get his half a biannual checkup, and his testosterone was up to 1200. So his doctor backed him off of the cream. So that's another benefit that C60 has. And you can go to our website. We have a lot of the science that's associated with human studies. They put C60 on skin cells and then exposed them to UV light, and the cells line that had the C60 resisted light. They also had some human nerve cells in the test tube, right? And they gave them C60 because you can't really do that certain tests with people. It's not ethical. And then they found that, when the cells that had C60 were able to resist a variety of neurotoxins. And that's why what is C60.org is important, because you can go there and see the animal studies rather than trying to find them out on the internet one at a time.
And what's the name of your website again?
Our website is shopc60.com.
That's right. Okay.
Shopc60.com, and you can see the science parts. But if you go to whatisc60.org, then you can get the human, the animal, and you'll see the difference. Particles of C60 have no efficacy, right? And whereas only has to be dissolved, and the industry hit piece, we have a couple of those, but they can't. They've actually pharmaceuticals have found that they can attach ligands to regular drugs to C60, and it works like HCl. I don't know if you look at sometimes you look at the drug things, there'll be HCl. So that's so it goes by your digestive system, the hydrochloric acid in your digestive system. But if you're going to buy C60, by the way, I'll give you the three things. First, you want 99.9% pure sublimated C60. Sublimation is like evaporation. It's when a solid turns to a gas, then back into a solid. That's done in a sublimator. Most C60 out there is actually solvent-based, solvent purified. And the solvent they use is methylbenzene, a known carcinogen. So you need to make sure that your C60 is sublimated. Don't get the industrial version. And another thing, and then of course you want to put it in a healthy oil, which is, and we use avocado oil, olive oil, and MCT oil. And we also have some pretty great gummies, which use whole coconut oil. This is a real, people just love the gummies. We'll send you some. And they taste really great. So don't eat too many. And the other thing that we do is, like, we learned this because we're in Colorado, is on all of our products, we have, oops, sorry, wrong side, we have a QR code. And so we found that 60% of all the, because when the C60 market was small, there was only like a handful of us, right? And everybody's producing a quality product for their customers, right? Because they were using it, their families were using it. But then once it became popular, all these fly-by-nighters, we found that 60% of all the C60, quote, C60 companies out there are lying. So you can go to our QR code and you can see your batch. Like when you test it, we send all our products after they're made to a third-party tester. They test for purity and concentration. So you know your product's safe and effective. And also, if you wander around in there, that you can see the COAs on our olive oil. So it's real olive oil. It's, farm source. It's not, cut with canola oil. And the same with the avocado and the MCT. And just because that's the way it is in this world.
Oh, I
Just
know.
buyers
Yeah.
beware.
Don't we know? Yeah. Great. Well, it's been fascinating. Some of it went over my head, not all of it, but I'm sure that for whoever wants to watch this all the way through will. And really enjoyed our time together. And I'm going to follow the story as it progresses. I really liked what you taught us about the all of it, really, but the platinum group metals, because I still have a little penchant toward that whole idea that we're not getting something for nothing, but certainly there are some energy sources that have been suppressed that we need to get going for the populace at large. We need to kind of circumvent the powers that be to continue our lives in, let's say, a better manner than what these controllers have in mind for us.
Well, that's why we open source the paper. Anybody can go there and do it, we're still fighting for the US patent, but the rest of the world's fine. We have the deuterium oxygen one that seems to be the energy source. You have all these others that seem to make these other metals of all types. So, I mean, it's like a new, it's a new frontier, and it's just beginning. And you know, besides the Scotia group, there's other people that are telling having good success with it. Some of them aren't saying anything because obviously they don't want people to know. But it's kind of a new thing, and yeah, I'm kind of it's see what happens.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ken.
Glad to be on.